Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Lisa Napoli, and even pro football players can make major financial fumbles. This one did.
Big mistake. Big, big mistake.
That's New Orleans Saints cornerback Mike McKenzie with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. He says by the end of his rookie year, he was broke, something he chalks up to one.
Big mistake. Big, big mistake.
So here's a quiz. What mistake did Mike make? Was it A, treating his friends to lots of fine meals all charged to his credit card? Or did he B, accidentally default on student loans? Stay current on those payments, people. Or was the problem C, shopping online over a non-secure connection? Mike was the victim of ID theft. Only one answer is correct. You'll find out which on this week's Marketplace Money, coming up from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
How do you get kids to eat their vegetables? Maybe you make a game out of it. Turns out, the same thing goes when you're trying to teach them about finances. I'm Lisa Napoli, in for Tess Figlin. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
This weekend, pro football is playing its first regular season game ever in London. But earlier this week, the National Football League teamed up with Visa for another very different event. At the Superdome in New Orleans, two high schools went head-to-head in a heated game of financial football. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler went to the Big Easy for the big event.
Students were set to battle via video game on Tuesday. So on Monday, I sought out an independent assessment. I sat down to play financial football on the computer with Mike Noble, an investment advisor with Crescent Sterling.
Get to choose what team you want to be.
Being from New Orleans, Noble picks the Saints from the list of football teams.
What city are you from?
I'm from Los Angeles. Good luck.
I settle on the Raiders as my proxy. The way it works is that in order to advance down the field, each team has to answer questions about money matters. Noble says financial football does a good job covering the basics, but he wonders if kids will expect better video game graphics.
The interaction is not as sophisticated as Xbox, but you get the point.
Nonetheless, Noble says it could be a valuable tool.
I've always found it hard to engage young people in this kind of conversation. I would just be curious to see what kind of results they're getting.
I got to see for myself. Seniors from rival schools gathered in the Saints' locker room at the Superdome. 16-year-old Jacques Landry was representing McDonough 35 High. I asked him what kinds of video games he normally plays.
Football, basketball, sports, basic sports.
He dreams of being a pro football player, so it's a big deal for him when Saints cornerback Mike McKenzie comes in and gives both teams an economic pep talk. McKenzie confessed that he didn't know how to budget when he went to college.
I had this credit card. Man, did I have this credit card? And to me, I mean, I had instant cash. I was like, all right, take the guys on out. We going to eat. Anybody have money? Nope. We'll just put it on here. Big mistake. Big, big mistake.
He fell into debt. He owed money even before he turned pro and collected a paycheck worth $300,000.
Before I knew it, before I made it through my rookie year, I was broke.
After he spoke, McKenzie took a seat with the team from McDonough High.
Are y'all ready for some football?
Whitney Martin reads the financial football questions to each team.
Which of these is not a liability? Not a liability. Paycheck, credit card balance, hospital bill, or money you owe a friend.
In the end, McDonough High took it.
That is a touchdown.
The kids definitely got into it. But does the game cover everything they need to know? I put the question to investment advisor Mike Noble.
The only shortcoming from my perspective is that it doesn't include many types of savings vehicles or investment vehicles that are available to young people today, especially when you start talking about IRAs and tax-deferred growth versus taxable growth. Those things are not covered in much detail, if at all.
Michael Rolnick helped create Financial Football for Visa.
This is to get kids started, and we can't overwhelm someone and make it daunting. And that's why I think the game packaging really helps get this education message across.
For more sophisticated stuff, Rolnick refers people to the website practicalmoneyskills.com. It's got college and graduate school level curriculums. As for our high school students, will they give it a try outside the classroom?
Yeah, I'll check it out, yeah.
I asked Jacques Landry how Financial Football compares to the video games he normally plays.
It's good, but it's education when you learn stuff. Even if you don't have the right answer, you'll learn something. It's good to play games like this.
Saints cornerback Mike McKenzie says playing this game is a first step.
And getting into the next step, which is investing, but you have to talk to them about saving it because it's hard to invest when you don't have anything.
Financial Football has been adopted by schools in 7 states. The Visa spokesman says there's a reason his company is involved in teaching kids. He says responsible consumers make better long-term clients. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace Money.
For more on Financial Football, visit practicalmoneyskills.com.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation. Online at kauffman.org.
This week, the Labor Department issued guidelines for companies hoping to comply with a new law that makes it easier for people to start saving for retirement. It's called the Pension Protection Act. If you get a new job or if you're working at a company and haven't signed up for the 401k plan, now you'll be automatically enrolled. David Ray is with the Profit-Sharing 401k Council of America. David, what are these new guidelines all about?
Automatic enrollment was pioneered about 10 years ago by McDonald's, and the interest in this has built over time as companies have experimented with this. And these regulations are really the culmination of a review process that has been underway for over 10 years. A number of companies already are doing this, but for the hundreds of thousands of companies that have 401k plans to move forward, they needed the security of a dotted I, cross T regulation. And these regulations now give them that kind of guide path.
Tell me more about what the regulations do and why they benefit me as an employee.
Well, if you are not participating in your 401k plan, the guide path on how the money is going to be invested is going to encourage your company to go ahead, automatically enroll you in the plan, and they're going to give you a decent 401k outcome even if you do nothing.
So basically, this rule will force everybody to have a 401k if their company offers it.
Well, it won't force them. The voluntary feature of the 401k remains, but if they don't say no, then this money is going to be withdrawn from their paycheck and invested for them. That's a huge 180-degree difference from the current approach, which has been the employee had to give permission and then make the investment decision.
Why is this rule a good thing?
The participation rate with the current voluntary approach seems to have plateaued at about 70%. We want every single person to be saving for retirement in these plans if they're offered. And so a new idea had to come about to fill that gap, get those other 30% of the people in the plans, or most of them, because some people will still opt out.
Are there any pitfalls to all of this? I mean, I can't imagine why somebody wouldn't want to be saving for retirement if their company made a provision for them to.
The downside is modest, but there is one, and that's we don't want automatic enrollment to become a standard of excellence. The ideal is still that the employee evaluate their own retirement needs. These plans, by their very nature, are not going to withdraw large amounts, for example, from an employee's paycheck. The ideal situation is that they still learn how to be long-term, savers and investment managers. But this certainly is a big step down the path for that other 30%.
David Ray is president of Profit Sharing 401k Council of America. Thank you, David.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money. I'm Lisa Napoli in for Tess Figland. This coming Wednesday is Halloween. It also happens to be my birthday. And just like everyone else, I'm not getting any younger. I was talking to my mom on the phone about it, and she started getting all philosophical.
So for your birthday, you have to start doing something, not just for you, but to say what you're going to do in your afterlife.
Hey, Mom, I'm not that old. But see, my mother is paid to think this way. She's a financial planner and stockbroker. She's used to having these kinds of conversations. And she knew exactly how I should start writing my last will and testament.
If you're going to have people have a party for you, first of all, so you put something in there saying, hey, let's have a big party. And then you think of the people who would benefit, who really would use your money the way you'd want it used.
That was actually fun to imagine. See, I don't have a traditional family, but I've got lots of friends and kids in my orbit, some who don't have a whole lot of cash, and there are causes I like to support. So next, I talked to a lawyer named Eric Matlin. Of course, he agreed with my mother.
Every single person is going to face, we're all going to die, and just looking away from it doesn't make it any less likely to happen.
Eric's written a book for people like me. It's called The Procrastinator's Guide to Wills and Estate Planning. He said once I knew who I wanted to give my money to, I needed to tally up my cash.
A general picture of your assets is good enough. What kind of insurance, life insurance, do you have?
And other things I own, like my car. Once I divvied up who would get what, I went online to the do-it-yourself website LegalZoom. Chaz Rampenthal is a lawyer there. I asked him the difference between a will and a living trust.
The benefit of a trust over a will is that a trust can avoid probate. The process of probate is when you take your will and your executor files it with the court.
Mm-hmm.
And when that will is filed with the court, obviously it becomes public, and then the assets are distributed according to that will.
Even if none of my heirs disputes what's in the will, probate can take months or even a year and cost a good chunk of change. Setting up a trust instead of just a will avoids that. The tricky and annoying part is what Chaz says I have to do next.
You need to contact each one of your accounts and ask them what paperwork you need to do with them that transfer those assets in there.
The money is still mine, and I'll have total control over it. But now all of my accounts will be in something called the Lisa Napoli Trust. Makes me sound really rich, doesn't it? Chaz promised all this is fairly straightforward, even though it seems a bit daunting. While I was at it, I did a living will and power of attorney, too. I always promised myself I would after the Terry Schiavo case a few years back. And now that I've got a handle on all this practical stuff, it's time to figure out the fun part of celebrating my birthday. Thanks, Mom. Coming up, what would you do with the $60,000 windfall? Chris has some ideas in the mailbag. And with fires raging in Southern California this week, we meet a guy who works on the front lines.
If I underpredict, people could be trapped, possibly by fire.
A day in the work life of a fire behavior specialist. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Lisa Napoli, in for Tess Figland. We aired this next story just a month and a half ago. Back then, firefighters were getting a big Southern California fire under control. And as we all know, that was a temporary reprieve. We thought this a fitting time to revisit the day in the work life of a fire behavior specialist. He spent this week helping battle this latest round of blazes. At the time, we found him on the job in Idaho.
From up here on top of the ridge, I could get a better look down into the drainage where we're trying to hold the fire. The smoke's kind of cleared out of the drainage a fair amount. which means it's probably drying out pretty quick. Fire activity will probably be picking up in there pretty decent next 2 to 3 hours. I'm Mike Powell. I'm the fire behavior analyst on the California Team 3. Right now, the fire isn't behaving very well. To tell you a little bit, I think we're into a big fight here this afternoon. The trees, they want to burn. They'll send up embers and they'll cause spot fires out in front of it. The terrain is real steep. Fire generally likes to run uphill because heat rises, and so this thing's been running uphill quite a bit. I think this is day 6. And how am I feeling right now? Actually, reasonable. You know, it's definitely times where I'm mentally stressed out, because if I underpredict, then the fire can move into places we weren't expecting it to move. People could be trapped, possibly, by fire. You're never perfect, and personally, I'd like to be perfect. I get a lot of my information just from listening to the radio. I'm scanning a bunch of different channels, and so I'm listening to what other people are saying about what's happening.
It's definitely a lot more active right now as compared to the same time yesterday.
There are computer models, and you can look at those, but computers can't model nature completely is the biggest problem. If you start walking up the hills, you find out how steep they really are. If you're walking through the grass, you'll see how thick it is. You'll hear things crackle under your feet that tells you a different story. To become a fire behavior expert, there are some classes that you have to take, but it's really just a real small part of it. A lot of it's the experience that you've had. I've been a firefighter since 1980, and personally I still like to consider myself a firefighter if I can get away from this job and the computers for a little bit. Been on hot shot crews for 10 years, worked on engines for about 5, and I've gotten to see quite a bit of fire in quite a few different places, and in my mind that's really what is needed to be a fire behavior analyst. The people out here actually don't make a whole lot of money. The general firefighter that's a federal employee makes probably about $12 an hour in normal rates. They do get a lot of overtime when they're out here. They would be working 16-hour days. They'll be getting hazard pay on top of that. So, you know, it may get up to like $18-$20 an hour. Don't get extra money for being a fire behavior specialist. Generally, I'll make about $70,000 a year, but it's taken pushing 30 years to get to this point, too. You can get by on it. You know, hopefully they enjoy doing it, and I think that's why a lot of these people are really out here, is because you can feel good about doing the job that you're doing.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Elizabeth Wynn Johnson.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org. False promises bring us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, rescissions. Rescission usually means canceling a contract by mutual agreement, but some insurers think it means canceling when they have to pay up. They sign up customers for a policy, but when a claim is filed, they revoke it. The companies say they issue rescissions only if customers hide information when they apply. But this week, California regulators said insurers can't do it unless they prove a customer intentionally lied. In other words, they might have to use a little more rescission precision. Got a box full of letters. Well, you can tell by the music that it's that time in the show where we take on your financial questions. I'm Lisa Napoli, and with me to answer those questions is Marketplace Money's own financial editor, Chris Farrell. Hi, Chris.
How are you doing, Lisa?
I'm good. And before we get to these questions, Chris, I want to remind everybody to take down our website. It's marketplace.org. If you click on the contact button, you can send us a question. Or if you like, you can give us a call at 1-877-275-6669. That's 1-877-ASK-MONEY. Right, Chris?
That's right. I think we should, let's just apologize to all those teachers that are running spelling bees. It's not our fault that it's spelled M-O-N-Y.
I know. It goes straight to the top.
Exactly.
Our first caller today, Chris, is Yana. She's from Detroit Lakes, Minnesota. You would think it would be Michigan, but it's confusingly in Minnesota. Hi, Yana.
Hello.
Yana, tell me about this Detroit Lakes, Minnesota, which I keep saying is Detroit Lakes, Michigan.
Right, right.
Yana, what do you do up there in the Detroit Lakes area?
I'm a grant writer for a nonprofit organization that is on the White Earth Indian Reservation. The programs that we work on are pretty diverse. There's a lot of sustainable agriculture that we promote. We're promoting alternative energy, Anishinaabe cultural revitalization.
And just like public radio, I'd imagine the salary is not great, but the psychic rewards are excellent.
Oh, yeah. Racking up the karma, karma point.
But, Yana, it sounds like you've got a question that people all across the United States might ask, and it has to do with saving for retirement. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's what it adds up to.
Why don't you, since Chris is on the line and he's the man of the hour, what would you ask Chris now that you got him on the line?
Well, I'm trying to assess my financial situation and project toward retirement, and the timing has to do with the fact that I've started a new job and will be starting a new retirement plan with a different company. And I want to find out if I should be squirreling away absolutely everything I possibly can for retirement, or if I am doing better than I think I am and might have some money to play with.
Oh, I hope we can have some money to play with. I mean, we always want balance. Squirreling away everything you can is probably not the way to go. One of the things I think most people have found out when they participate in a 403B or a 401K is how easy it is to get to the maximum and it not affect the issues that you're concerned about. It has less of a burden. And the impact on lifestyle is less than you would think looking at the raw figures, a big reason being because it's pre-tax income.
Yana, you're trying to factor into some things that you've done in the past with retirement money, right?
Right. I know this is a huge no-no, and there's a special circle of hell for people who do this, but I have taken money out of my retirement account, not once, but twice.
No. It's just Dante's Purgatorio. We don't go to hell.
Oh, okay.
Like that. It's just Purgatorio. Because let me tell you, everybody listening to this, and I think I can say this, I know I can say this for myself, you know, we've all done much bigger mistakes than in our financial lives. It's one of those things you don't want to do, but it's not the worst thing that you can do. You just end up paying some taxes and a 10% penalty.
Well, so I have an existing account that has around $36,000 in it right now.
Well, you've been saving.
Is it? I keep thinking, wow, that's okay. So that's about 1 year of retirement right there.
Right. I know.
But Chris, it's important for Yana, now that she's got this new gig, to, as you were saying in the beginning, max out what she can put away with her 401k.
That's right. And if it turns out that going to the maximum is just going to be too much, you know, put in the maximum that you feel comfortable putting in and then see how that affects you. See how that affects what you take home, what your spending is doing. Put yourself into a well-diversified portfolio. And I think most of the major mutual fund companies at this point have very good websites dealing with the basics of retirement and diversification. But I think if you're aggressive and you're putting aside, 10, 11% of your income a year, that's pretty good.
That sounds pretty good to me, too. Yana, has Chris's advice helped you? I hope so.
Yes, that's helpful. Thank you very much.
Thanks for sharing your story with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Bye.
Bye.
Chris, now we've got an email. Kim from Hampton Falls, New Hampshire. She says she and her husband love traveling, and they're concerned about the falling value of the U.S. dollar. Is there a resource where they can compare how far their dollars will go in different countries? I sure could have used that this summer when I went to Europe. How about it, Chris?
Yeah, you picked like the worst place to go to, at least on a currency basis.
Yes, at the worst time.
Yes, at the worst time. Yahoo has a very good currency converter. It's finance.yahoo.com and then x-rates.com. Either one of those sites will do what they want. It's a very smart idea, by the way, with the declining value of the dollar. Sort of do a little experimenting. And, you know, maybe Europe's not the best place to be going right now, but there might be other parts of the globe where a dollar will go farther and your trip will be at least a little less financially painful.
Is traveling your thing, but you're so worried about your lack of cash that you never leave the house? Well, with a little planning, you never know where you could end up. Let us help. Click on the contact button on our website, marketplace.org, or call us at 1-877-275-6669. That's 1-877-ASK-MONY. Our second caller today is Sam. He's from Milwaukee. That's a place whose name I know. Hi, Sam.
Hi.
How's it going in Milwaukee today?
It's a little colder than it's been, but it's fine.
Are you drinking a lot of beer? I always imagine that you guys drink a lot of beer in Milwaukee.
Many of them do. It is the beer capital. I'm more of a wine guy myself.
I was just going to say, I'm a wine gal, so we'll get a lot. There are good wine stores in Milwaukee?
Oh, sure. There are a lot of Germans here, so I've learned to drink German wines, which I never really understood, but now I'm getting into the Rieslings.
That's a good thing. I understand you have a complicated situation. Why don't you let us know what that is?
Okay. My wife has $98,000 in loans.
Student loans.
Student loans. Right. No other kind of debt.
Good.
And I have no other kind of debt. And recently we were able to enjoy the profits from a sale. Basically, we have $60,000 that just came into the household. And the question is, because the student loan debt is so large, the annual interest on $98,000 or so has been way in excess of $2,500, which is the maximum federal deduction on student loan interest. But my understanding is that on mortgage interest or home equity line of credit, there is no cap. So to me, I'm thinking, well, if I had $98,000 in cash, I would just pay off the loan so that we could get them off our back and that the monthly cash flow would be better. The monthly cash flow on the loans is over $800 and it's fixed. If we pay off some of the loan, that doesn't change the monthly payments until it's all paid off. So to me, it doesn't make sense to pay off some of the student loans. It's either continue on the schedule that we're on and just pay a little bit every month, or pay off the entire thing to get it off our back. So the only way to pay off $98,000 would be, in my mind, to put the $60,000 in cash that we have into the home, for example, into our, you know, pay off our mortgage and then get a home equity line of 98 and just pay off the student loans entirely. And then all the interest on the home equity line would be tax deductible. And in my mind, it should make sense because it's interest one way or the other. It's just in one case, the deduction is $2,500 max. And in past years, the interest on the student loans has been $6,600 a year. Is my logic or is my reasoning sound?
Okay, I have a couple of reactions to it. One is when you put more and more debt onto the home, particularly if you're taking student loan debt and you turned it into home equity loans, you're giving up a fair amount of flexibility. As a general rule, what I'm very wary is people loading on non-equity debt, non-home equity debt onto their homes, because then you're putting your home at risk if your financial circumstances did change for the negative, and you're loading more and more debt onto your home, which you get a tax advantage. You're absolutely right. You know, you'll get a deduction depending on what your income is. So the question that I have is why not be more aggressive in paying it off the student loan more quickly? If you increase and are more aggressive in paying down the student loans, you will reduce the overall cost of that borrowing significantly. And at the same time, you don't increase your risk of home ownership.
That makes sense. I totally understand why it probably too risky to put my home in that kind of jeopardy when I don't have to necessarily. I think it might be a psychological issue, which I don't like about the student loans, which is the monthly payment is $882. If I were to pay off $30,000, if I were to knock it down from $98 to $68 in terms of what we owe, the monthly payments would not change at all. That makes me angry because that hurts my cash flow.
I don't blame you, but if you go to one of the websites, FinAid is one of them, College Board is another, you know, they all have calculators on student loans. And if you just plug in the numbers, mm-hmm. what the difference will be, the overall cost, if you pay that $30,000 toward it, because there's no prepayment penalty with student loans.
Right.
It actually ends up having a big difference in what the overall cost of that education is going to be to your bottom line.
Understood. Sounds good to me.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Thank you very much.
If you've got a question for Chris, give us a call. It's 1-877-275-6669. That's 1-877-ASK-MONY. Or if you're shy, you can visit our website, marketplace.org. Click on the contact button. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Okay, Chris, we have one final email. Adrian from Falls Church, Virginia. Adrian was listening to an Educating RICO segment on Roth IRAs, and he has a question about a similar topic. Last year, his company started a Roth 401k program that, due to the large and very generous company match, lucky Adrian, many in the company started participating in and contributing heavily to. His company was recently bought out by another one, and he rolled that 401k into a Roth IRA. And he's heard from some financial blogs can sometimes be of specious origin, that all of the principal he contributed plus the interest from the Roth 401k are considered principal in his Roth IRA and can be withdrawn anytime penalty-free. Sounds too good to be true.
Sounds too good to be true because even with if you set up a regular Roth IRA, let's say you put in the maximum of $4,000 this year, mm-hmm. and you're under 50, so you just maximum $4,000 this year, you can withdraw that $4,000 without penalty, right? Because mm-hmm. it's just a contribution, but you can't withdraw the interest. There you get hit by the penalty and everything else because there's all the rules that apply. There's a five-year taxable waiting period. You have to be over 59 and a half, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, no, I cannot imagine that you can touch the interest at all. But essentially, that's saying that you could touch the earnings before retirement. And the bottom line is, when it comes to a Roth IRA or any retirement savings plan, in general, always keep this rule in mind, 59 and a half, plus with a Roth, you have to have it for a five-year taxable period.
Sounds like what the bloggers are telling him isn't right.
As far as withdrawing the interest, that's correct.
Right. Good. We just learned something. Thank you.
You're welcome.
But that's all we can talk about this week. If you want to talk to us in future weeks, leave your question for our program on our voicemail, 1-877-275-6669. That's 1-877-ASK-MONY. Or you can visit our website, marketplace.org, and click on the contact page. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks a lot, Lisa.
Coming up, forget all that HMO paperwork. Some doctors are going back to the basics.
It's only a couple of steps away from, you know, taking two chickens and some fresh cow's milk down to old Doc Potter while you're getting your tonsils looked at.
Why more doctors are scrapping health insurance. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Lisa Napoli, in for Tess Figland. Here's the latest twist on the healthcare crisis. Doctors who are so fed up with the HMO system that they're not taking insurance anymore. Marketplace's Sam Eaton found a growing number are going cash only.
It took Madeline Deutsch about 3 years working as a full-time ER physician in Los Angeles to come to this conclusion.
Patient care generally comes after a number of other priorities. And I just was finding that I was just being less and less satisfied with my work.
In the maze of insurance forms and liability procedures, Deutsch says she lost touch with the reason she first became a doctor. That's when she decided to not only break out on her own, but to break away from the entire managed care system.
I wanted to bring medicine to the every person on the street at a reasonable cost that I felt was still a fair rate of getting paid for me and that would keep me happy.
Deutsch opened a bare-bones general practice in downtown Los Angeles about a year ago. Instead of accepting insurance, she charges a flat fee of $70 for annual checkups and basic office visits and up to $200 for more complicated health problems. She'll even make house calls.
It's only a couple of steps away from, you know, taking two chickens and some fresh cow's milk down to old Doc Potter, and Doc Potter's wife would be making cookies for you while you're getting your tonsils looked at.
This out-of-pocket approach to health care has grown in recent years. The nonprofit Center for Studying Health System Change reports that 11.5% of U.S. physicians no longer accept insurance plans. That's up from about 9% in 2001. The center's president, Paul Ginsberg, says the reason is a matter of simple economics.
These physicians have been hurt, and their incomes have been eroding. And in fact, you know, in real terms, their incomes have dropped 10% over the last decade.
By some estimates, primary care clinics now need about 6 support staff for every doctor in order to process all the insurance paperwork and referrals. That makes it increasingly tough for family physicians to stay in the black. But insurers say their main responsibility is to keep patients' costs down. Susan Pisano is with the industry's chief lobbying group, America's Health Insurance Plans.
Consumers benefit because the role of the health insurance plan is to negotiate with physicians and hospitals for rates that otherwise might not be available to individual patients.
State regulators are also worried about the trend, but for different reasons. Wisconsin Insurance Commissioner Sean Dilwig says as soon as patients step outside of an insured system, the state can no longer protect them.
You're on your own as far as do the rates increase month to month? Is the physician there when you need them? And if you have a dispute, you're then at the whim of your court system to resolve the dispute.
That's a trade-off many are willing to take. Madeline Deutsch says even though her rates are significantly higher than the average insurance copay, the patients are lining up.
I get probably 1 to 2 inquiries a day, and I'm scheduling 4 to 5 new people a week at this point.
One of those new patients is Jennifer Moeller. She has insurance but chooses to pay extra in order to see Dr. Deutsch.
I may have more of an expenditure at, you know, the front end of healthcare, but when it comes to a long-term investment and the long-term payoff, there will be a benefit.
That benefit, she says, is having a doctor with more time to focus on prevention rather than paperwork. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
About 4 years ago, some people in the Bay Area started something they call the Compact. They vowed not to buy anything new for 6 months. Well, 6 months turned into a year, and now some of them have a goal of never buying anything new ever, with the exception, of course, of food and other necessities like toilet paper. Tess Vigeland has been following one of these families. It's part of American Public Media's Consumed special coming up in a couple of weeks. Today, she introduces us to the Mullen family.
I first spoke with Angelique Mullen on January 3rd of this year. She's 36 years old and lives in Daly City, California, with her husband Terry, who's 38. They have a 5-year-old daughter, Daphne, and their son Henry was just 9 months old when we talked in January. He joined his mom in the studio, sippy cup in hand and ready to hit on the table. I started by asking Angie how she describes her own consumer habits.
I think I'm a conscious consumer, or at least I try to be. But I do have my moments of weakness. I go crazy in a yarn store or craft supplies. I'm definitely not a clothes horse, or I'm not a shoeaholic or anything like that. So I don't go to the mall and go shopping, but I will tend to sometimes go to Target or something, a store like that, and spend more than I need to on things that I shouldn't be buying.
Well, let me ask you to kind of put yourself on the couch. Where do you think that comes from in terms of how you grew up, how you entered adulthood, how you became a consumer? How do you think your spending habits evolved?
Well, you know, I grew up with a single mother, and we didn't have a whole lot of money growing up. In fact, there were times in our childhood when we really had no money. And, you know, as I got older and I started earning my own money, it took a long time to become responsible, I think. I took out a lot of student loans when I was younger, still paying them off. it wasn't until after I got married, my husband and I started sitting down and figuring out, you know, how to take care of our finances. He's much better about it than I am. He didn't come into our marriage with debt. We are trying now to be very conscious about how we spend our money and where it goes. That's part of why we decided to do this compact.
Let's talk a little bit about this compact. What is it?
My husband and I have decided to spend the whole year not buying any brand new consumer items, you know, aside from the essentials like food and sundries. And there are a couple of exceptions, but we're basically trying to take, we think of it as a fast. We're doing a consumer fast for the year.
When you're saying that you're not going to buy any new consumer goods, how do you decide what is a necessity and what is extra?
Well, my husband and I sat down on New Year's Eve and tried to make a list of what we thought was essential. We have two cats, so in my view, cat litter is kind of an essential. toilet paper and shampoo and soap are essentials. He thinks razors are essential. They're not to me. So he's going to probably buy razors to shave. I have enough that I can make do, Food is obviously anything related to food. I'm just not even going to argue about it. I think that we can't starve ourselves. And we have made a couple exceptions, and that is socks and underwear and new brand new shoes for our family, because actually all four of us are going to need brand new shoes this year, especially Henry, because he'll start walking.
Yeah, well, in Henry's case, I mean, as a 9-month-old, he's going to be growing leaps and bounds over the next 12 months. How do you not buy new things for him?
Clothes can be purchased used. We actually have two boxes of boy clothes that were given to me by a few friends. And if he needs anything, we'll just take it on a case-by-case basis. But I do think we plan to try to get everything used.
Well, if you're really, really honest with yourself, how do you feel about the prospect of doing this for the next 12 months?
I feel really good about it. I feel excited about it. It's a challenge, and I think that's one of the things that appeals to me about it. And I know that there are a lot of people I know and friends and family who probably think we're nuts. And then for some reason, that makes me want to do it even more. I don't feel scared about it. I think because we've been working toward it for a long time. I mean, the idea took hold several years ago, actually, before I even heard of the compact. And it just was growing in my head for a long time, the idea of it. And of course, last year I had a baby, and that didn't seem like a good time to start it. And we would go for a while. We do a month-long fast here and there. But this time, it seems like it's something I'm really ready for, and I think my husband is too. So it just seemed like the right time.
So how have the first couple of days been?
Fine. I haven't gone to one store. I haven't even bought groceries. But I know I'm going to have to do that actually today, later. But I don't feel tempted in any way, shape, or form.
How long do you think that's going to last?
You know, I don't. As long as I stay out of stores, I tend to be okay.
That's Angelique Mullen talking with Tess back in January. Next week, we find out how the Mullins were faring 2 months into their experiment. I'm Lisa Napoli, sitting in for Tess Vigeland. She returns next week. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
looks like it's going to be the best quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It is time once again for our economics editor, Chris Farrell, to help us sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what's the straight story. Chris, we talked earlier in the show about 401k plans, and I know you always advise people to contribute to their plans, at least up to their match. I'd like to say I follow that guidance religiously.
Oh, that makes me so happy. It's free money. It means that every month you outperform Warren Buffett, the greatest investor of the post-World War II era.
But this week, we've got a case where the company match might not have been quite up to snuff on the Warren Buffett scale. It has to do with the mortgage lender Countrywide. They've obviously not been having such a hot year with the housing market. Tell us about this problem.
Here's what happened. An employee at Countrywide filed a lawsuit alleging that the workers lost hundreds of millions of dollars in their 401k retirement plan. And the reason is the company match, it was in the form of Countrywide stock.
Hmm.
Well, here's the straight story. Whatever the merits of the lawsuit, it's a basic money mistake to bet your financial future on one company. Remember the marketplace money mantra: diversify, diversify, diversify.
But the thing is, what if the company is offering you this option? Wouldn't you want to take it just because it's a freebie from the company?
That's exactly right. And it's a temptation, and Countrywide was a hot performing stock for many years. And if I have the figure right, it looks like about a third of the 401ks in company stock. But remember, many good companies run into trouble, i.e. Countrywide stock, since its high of February 2nd, is down a little over 50%.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're looking long term, and you're investing for your future, you want to diversify away from your current risks. And one of your current risks is that your job and your income is already tied to this company. You don't want to then tie your retirement to its stock.
Gotcha. No, and this all sounds awfully Enron-esque. And I thought after Enron, Congress made it easier for employees to sell their company's stock if it was in a retirement savings plan, just like the Countrywide CEO apparently has been doing over the past year, too, to the tune of, $138 million?
That's right. Now, Congress did make some good moves, and there has been an improvement in the situation, so I don't want to exaggerate. I mean, one of the things Congress said is that companies, if they do the match in company stock, they have to inform the employees that after 3 years, you can sell your stock. There are limits in how much of the portfolio can go into company stock. And the good news is, if I remember the figures from Hewitt Associates, a big human resources company, before Enron, about 36% of companies were doing the match in company stock. And we're down in the low 20% now. Nevertheless, companies and employees need to realize that this is a very risky strategy. The retirement savings plan is not the place to reward employees with stock.
So if I work for a company that is high-flying and I do want to take advantage of this kind of thing, I should just make sure it's not tucked away in my retirement fund, right?
Right. So then what you would do is you'd really pay attention, and at the three-year mark, you liquidate your holdings as of that point. Hopefully, more and more companies abandon this practice. And frankly, I like to see Congress tighten up the rules. Now, one of the rules that is very good in a traditional pension plan, the kind that our parents had,
mm-hmm.
Now there's a rule that no more than 10% of the portfolio can be in any one stock. That's not a bad rule.
All right. That's a straight story from our man, Chris Farrell. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks a lot, Lisa.
This week, we got a sneak peek at something very cool, a totally green house being constructed here in Los Angeles.
It's a 4,200-square-foot home.
Steve Glenn did a walkthrough with us at the top-secret location near the end of a cul-de-sac in Brentwood. His company, Living Homes, is all about environmentally friendly buildings, and he's built this demo with Wired magazine.
It is a prefabricated home. So it was assembled in 3 days.
What can you describe for us right where we are right now, what we're seeing?
We're in the top floor, so this is the kitchen and the dining room, living room over there, the media room over there.
And 5 bedrooms and baths on the lower level. This is a sleek, modern house with giant windows and gorgeous views, but looks are obviously not the point.
What can you tell us of what we're seeing right now is green?
Sort of everything. I mean, so, for example, the concrete that you're standing on, we mix in fly ash. Fly ash is what you get when you burn coal. The wood on the ceiling and the exterior is reclaimed redwood, and it's in its third use. So it started as a bridge, was then deconstructed and used for the ceiling of, I think, an army barrack. And now it's part of this home. Steel, the home is mostly made of steel, is the most recycled building material. 50% of the content is recycled. And you can even source more. So basically, it's old cars, steel is. There is insulation made out of soybean and also cellulose, newspaper mixed with cellulose.
There are low-flow toilets, of course, and the landscaping doesn't require much watering, essential here in the desert. Then there's the high-tech part of the house, a home automation system that lets you control the lights, the heating, and the cooling, and lets you swap audio and video from room to room. You'd expect a guy like Steve to drive a Prius, and he does, and this house has a similar kind of dashboard.
It shows in real time, over the internet, what you're using in any minute, how much power you're consuming, how much you're producing when you are from the photovoltaics. You can see carbon averted, You can see money saved.
Now, of course, most of us don't have the $300 a square foot to build this kind of environmentally responsible steel and glass wonder. But Steve says you're starting to see this notion of green seep into all kinds of home building.
Cities are either rewarding you if you build in a responsible way or increasingly requiring it or penalizing you if you don't. And frankly, many of the things are no more expensive than non-sustainably developed counterparts.
And they'll get cheaper as more people use them.
All of the things that are more expensive now will come down with volume. I mean, that's how things get less expensive, with volume.
And even for those of us who can't imagine buying any kind of house, Steve says there's something green every one of us can do right now.
If every household in the U.S. were to change one light bulb from incandescent to compact fluorescent, it would be the equivalent of taking 1 million cars off the streets. That's huge.
And for the price of a couple of light bulbs, you can check out the Living Homes Wired House in person over the next couple of weeks. Visit our website, marketplace.org, for details. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, a look at a very special hairdresser.
I am working 6 days a week. Really, seven, because I work at church.
Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas, Rico Galliano, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Philippi, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Lisa Napoli. Tess Vigeland will be back next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.